"What happened to you?" she asks. And for a second he isn't sure what she means, because he's been concentrating on her injuries. "Last night," he says, "Fella got me." He feels himself blushing. "I was following you home, along the tracks. I wanted to ask you something."
"What?"
"Well, I know the answer now. I was just going to ask you why you kept coming around me."
"Because you're the only good man I know."
Ginger feels ashamed. Sydney is behind them now. He picks up speed on the shore road.
"I'm sorry I ignored you at the picture house," she says. "It's better for Lily's sake if she doesn't know anything."
"That's your little sister." He turns. There's just enough dark to swallow her wounds and light her eyes. She gives him a calm, knowing look. It's like an invitation to rest. It says, "Don't try anymore. Stop fighting. I know. I understand something that's so deep you think it's behind you, but it isn't. It's inside you. Let me touch it."
"Lily," he says, "that's a pretty name."
He sounds foolish to himself. Something has hit his stomach like a fiery drink, and it's spreading out through his limbs. He shakes it off.
"You and me make a fine team, eh?" he chuckles.
"What do you mean?"
Her voice is so grown up he feels callow, but he presses on.
"I mean the two of us with our racked up faces. What a sight."
He turns to her and laughs, and she smiles slightly, as he's glad to see by the light of an oncoming car. Francis keeps one eye on the road as the headlights of the Kissel slice by the truck.
"Can this thing go any faster?"
she wants to know. At Teresa's house, Hector rocks quietly by the kitchen stove and follows the conversation with his eyes. Adelaide is sick with worry.
"I have to go out there, Teresa. She's got him. Oh, my God."
She leans over and holds her stomach.
"Settle down now. I'll tell you what we're going to do, Addie. First, we're going to find out if she's home, 'cause if she's there, nothing to be worried about. We'll get Wilf Beale to drive us out and..."
"Okay, here's what we're going to do. Listen now.
I'll go up to the door and say old Mahmood is dying and wants to see his granddaughters at the last minute. And if Piper says forget it, I'll let him know there could be money in the will, you know? And then I say Mahmood also says for them all to come or none, so we'll know if Francis isn't there."
"What are you doing, girl? Sit down."
"Where is Hector's gun?"
"What do you want with it?"
"Don't ask foolish questions and shut up with your foolish ideas."
Hector stares wide-eyed at Adelaide and points a finger at the top cupboard. Adelaide climbs onto the kitchen counter, and Teresa seizes her around the knees.
"I'm warning you, Treese."
"Eddie, come on now."
Woomph, a back foot to the stomach.
"I'm sorry, dear."
Adelaide fishes the rifle from on top of the cabinet.
"Thank you, Hector."
"That thing doesn't even work anymore," says Teresa, still on the floor.
Adelaide fires it into the ceiling. Teresa screams.
"It works."
Adelaide hops down from the counter, calm, the way people are when they've gone over the edge. Teresa talks fast.
"All right, Eddie. We'll get Wilf and we'll drive till we find them. No point going out to their house. She's with him. So let's calm down and go get a ride."
By the time the Jamils left with their last load, James was stone-cold drunk. He climbed into his immaculate 1932 close-coupled Buick sedan and started it up. It's a tan color. Gangsters have black cars. he drove at a moderate speed back to New Waterford. He had decided not to bother finding a rifle. The best close-up killing is done with a bayonet. A rifle is really just an appendage, useful if the blade gets stuck in the ribs and you have to shoot free. But once you've been around for a while, you know how to avoid making noise. Under and up. Stop! Pine branches bend and squeak against Ginger's truck. This isn't even a road. He cuts the engine. We have to walk from here, Francis says. Take my hand. He does. It's necessary. After all, she knows the way, he doesn't, and it's such a dark night. Such a slim, soft hand. Mercedes is dusting the piano. She has taken all the figurines and doilies off it, and she is about to apply the lemon oil when Daddy comes in. Give me the keys to the hope chest, Mercedes. He reeks of liquor. Mercedes is scared. What's wrong, Daddy? But she knows enough to have the keys in her outstretched hand while asking. Don't worry, my dear. I won't be long. He takes the stairs two at a time without hurrying. Mercedes screws the lid back on the lemon oil, wipes her hands, and follows him up two flights to the attic. He's on his knees with the contents of the hope chest scattered over the floor. What happened to the old-fashioned girl? He asks gently, holding it in his hand. I knocked her over while dusting, Daddy. I didn't want to hurt you by saying so. I'll get you a new doll, Mercedes. He goes back to rummaging. I'm sorry about this mess. Trixie hops down from the window ledge and hugs the wall on her way out. Mercedes feels icy cold. He sounds so strange, just 2 inches off to the side of his normal self. How does it add up with how drunk he must be? The smell reminds her of how sick she always feels, even when she's feeling fine. He finds what he's looking for at the very bottom. Ouch! He was prepared to find it in need of a quick grinding. But it's razor sharp, though he remembers laying it in the chest, dull with the war. Just as well, he thinks, as he sucks a bead or two from his fingertip. Where are you going, Daddy? He pats her heavily on the head, this man who never touches her. You stay and look after your sister. What are you fellas doing up there? Lily from the bottom of the attic stairs. Go back to bed, Mercedes orders. James trots down the attic stairs, calling back to Mercedes. I have to find Francis. No! Mercedes has shrieked it. Lily is shocked. The sound is stranger than Daddy kissing the top of her head with a long knife in his hand. Mercedes leaps into the dark shaft of the attic stairway, catching and propelling herself by the palms of her hands against the walls. James seizes her by the wrists as she lands in the hallway and nearly drops the bayonet, now at an angle. Lily doesn't take her eyes off it. I'm not going to hurt Francis. I'm after the man who's been at her, that's all. He's starting to feel the liquor now. My little girl. He wheels to face the top of the stairs leading down to the front hall, and he puts his bayonet hand on the railing. I'll be right back. Mercedes puts a hand over Lily's eyes. Then she pushes her father down the stairs. The ground slopes sharply upward. They've reached the hill with a drift mine cut into it. There's a bit of a climb, says Francis. I'll go in front. He bends to the hill and they start up. She gasps, and her hand slips from his. He flings out an arm, catching the sleeve of her uniform. You okay? Yes, she gets up. Ow! Wait now. He lifts her into his arms, light as a feather. She slips an arm around his neck of necessity and, with quiet dignity, thank you. He carries her up the hill. There. He places her gently on the ground before an arch of complete darkness.
You can go now, Mr. Taylor.
He is nonplussed. He can't just leave her here, in the dark, can he?
Wait, Francis. Don't you have a flashlight? Have you got a blanket or something in there?
Don't worry about me. I'll be fine. Goodbye.
She turns, becomes pure shadow, then is swallowed by the mouth of the mine.
Francis!
But she doesn't answer. He shifts his weight. He leans into the darkness.
Francis!
He hesitates. He enters the pit. Feeling his way with one hand along the damp wall, the other hand outstretched, walking slowly, slowly, listening for her steps.
Francis!
Why is he whispering? And why does she not answer? Step, step, step over the uneven floor. He lets go of the wall and lights a match. Nothing but the dank shine to one side of him and below, his dusty boots looking up at him so trusting. The light goes out. Step, step. Both hands outstretched now. He walks for 2 long minutes. He stubs his toe on a stone, sending it scudding for an instant. Then 3 counts of silence before a wet plonk. That sound is called cutting the devil's throat. No splash. Deep water. His heart kicks. He claws for the wall, but it's farther away than he thought, which pitches him to the void in the opposite direction. He throws himself toward his feet, hurting his shoulder. The floor was closer than he thought. He lies curled on his side for a moment, almost sick with relief. To fall into God knows how deep a flooded shaft in the dark. The first heavy sinking, then panicking, losing up from down. That's how you drown, even when you're quite a good swimmer. He takes a big breath, and no sooner returns to his feet than, what if she's fallen in? He didn't hear a splash, but then she slipped away so quickly it could have happened before he stepped into the mine. Either that or... He lights his last match. Yes, a wide pool, black water. She may have slid beneath the surface, intending all along to drown herself tonight. The match goes out. He lowers himself carefully to the floor, stretches out on his stomach, and dips an arm down into the water, a prayer in his head, his heart full of dread, feeling around. Cold. Nothing. Something silky. Oh, Jesus! He travels screaming over cinders, yanked along by a sudden vice grip around his wrist, down into the water, plunging head and shoulders, waist. His knees grab the lip as he clutches an unseen arm in both his hands, hauling her up along with himself, breaking the surface with a torrent the sound of a hefty rag mop. She's naked. He finds her armpits and lays her on the rough ground. She doesn't answer. Her eyes are closed. He can feel that. He fumbles for her mouth, opens it, gasps for his own breath. Drowning people try to drown their saviors. Slips a hand beneath her head and presses his mouth onto hers, opening the cut in her lip. He tastes blood and it reminds him of life, still warm. He breathes into her. She coughs and starts to cry.
Are you all right, Francis? I didn't mean to hurt you, honey. Here.
He wants to tear off his jacket, shirt, wrap her up. But his clothes are soaking wet, so he folds her in his arms instead.
I'm sorry, she cries. I'm sorry.
And clings to him.
It's okay. It's okay.
He pats her shoulder blade. After a moment, her shivering subsides, and she strokes the back of his neck, kisses his cheek, grazing his ear.
Thank you. She rests her thigh between his legs and brushes his mouth accidentally with her lips.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Don't leave me, please. I'm so frightened of the dark.
Closer. I won't leave you, but... He's embarrassed to find he's hard. He didn't know till now he wanted her. Still doesn't know. Excuse me. And he moves to release her.
That's okay,
she whispers, kissing his mouth, moving next to him.
Oh,
she says, and her fingers sink into his shoulders. He pulls her a little closer without meaning to. She sighs again and reaches down.
That's okay, little ginger man.
Her voice is so gentle. She undoes his pants and slides against him.
That's okay.
And she says his secret name. He moans, misery and desire. Because with that, she's on to him and all around him, and he can only move inside her. Ginger's private name must not be written down. It's bad enough that Francis knows it. When Mercedes' hand uncovers Lily's eyes, Lily sees her father lying bunched up at the foot of the stairs. The bayonet has landed a safe 6 steps above him. In retrospect, Mercedes calculates that he was highly unlikely to land anywhere near the blade, considering the position of his hand on the railing and its loose grip on the weapon at the time of the fall. Furthermore, he was sufficiently drunk to render the fall likely non-lethal. But Mercedes faces the fact that she merely pushed, and calculated later. She has not read Dr. Freud. She takes no solace in the subconscious. She takes responsibility. She decides in that moment to stop her penance in the coal cellar. It appears to her suddenly as so much whining. Yes, she will confess this sin of pushing her father. But she knows now that no good act is ever unaccompanied by evil. That is what original sin has done to us. That is what makes us human. The necessity of sin itself is the cross we must bear. God did not put me on this earth to stand by while my sister Frances is killed. Beaten is one thing. Wrongly touched is one thing. Stabbed with a bayonet is another. Push. Be strong enough to carry the burden of sin that goes with doing the right thing. There is only one saint in this family, and I'm not it. God has made Mercedes a judge. No one loves you for that. Not like a crippled child who's prone to visions, whom Mercedes prizes. Not like a fallen woman who makes people laugh, whom Mercedes loves. Mercedes is standing straight as steel, staring down at James. Brown-eyed people are popularly believed to be soft somewhere. And warm. Look again. Lily walks carefully down the stairs in her bare feet, holding on to both railings. She bends over James. A line of spit runs from the corner of his mouth. She strokes his hair and gives him a kiss on the cheek. His eyelashes flutter. She looks up at Mercedes and says, "He's not dead." "Good. Now go to bed." Curled deep in the hope chest left open by James, Trixie hears Frances call her name and leaps out, padding down the stairs, across the hall, and into the room Frances used to share with Lily. But Frances is not here. There's just Lily kneeling at the window, her hands folded on the ledge, looking out. Trixie brushes the soles of Lily's feet as Mercedes swishes past the bedroom door, the bayonet flashing in her hand. Up in the darkness of the attic, Mercedes dumps everything back into the hope chest as quickly as possible, pressing its lid down snug against air and moths. Frances's eyes burst open. She had a dream about Trixie just now. Frances was calling and calling her, but Trixie was locked in a box and smothered.
It was just a dream. Don't move. Don't wake this man who's crushing me now.
Frances doesn't want to have to stand up and lose any of his goodness down her legs. And she'll have to stand up if he awakens, because he'll be clamoring to get out of here,
wondering what in the name of God he's done. And if he leaves, she'll have to go with him, because she sure as shooting doesn't intend to walk the 5 miles home. Not in what she hopes is her delicate condition. She'll lie still for another couple of hours.
Wiggle your toes.
James groans and lolls his head. Mercedes pours more ice water on his face, and he uncrumples with a jerk.
Good, she says.
She gets behind him, hooking her hands under his arms, and yanks him into a sitting position.
Help me now, she orders.
He slumps onto his knees.
She gets him standing,
then hauls him like timber into the front room, where he collapses onto the couch and passes out again. She looks at him with her arms folded for a moment, then leaves and returns with a blanket. She tosses it over him.
Advancing steadily toward the front of her mind is the memory of what she and Frances can't know together out loud. She has kept this memory on top of a pile of things at the back of her mind. Not buried. Right there where she can see it every time she passes the open door. But as long as she keeps it in the back room, she can believe that it belongs with the rest of the old junk. As long as she doesn't talk about it, it can remain overlooked by amateurs and experts alike. The gilt frame covered with dust, the painting gummed over with neglect. Who would guess what a piece of work lies dormant there? But it has stirred, torn itself from its frame, and now it's coming closer and closer. Stop!
That's far enough.
Mercedes takes the cap off the lemon oil and picks up her dust rag. If she's going to look at what just arrived behind her eyes, she has to have something to occupy her hands.
It was here in the living room.
The painting from the junk pile is called Daddy and Frances in the Rocking Chair.
But there never was a rocking chair in this room or any other. Just the pale green wing back. Mercedes' white rag goes round and round, bringing up the mahogany sheen on the piano.
It was the night of Kathleen's funeral.
I got up because Frances was gone from our bed. You could see her imprint in the snow sheets and pillow. I looked out at the creek, but she's not there.
Good.
Maybe she's gone downstairs for something to eat. She must be hungry by now. She hasn't had anything but imaginary food for 2 days.
I will go downstairs, too, and make cinnamon toast. I pictured myself and Frances eating cinnamon toast and drinking cocoa at the kitchen table. But I didn't put on my tartan housecoat or my slippers, which is how I know now I didn't really believe in the cinnamon toast. Bad things happen when Frances gets out of bed. I'm not afraid of the dark. I had 2 long French braids. On my way down the stairs, I heard a sound like a puppy.
I walked down the stairs toward the light spilling through the front room archway on the right.
To the left is the dark kitchen, and a smell like the inside of someone's body. In the front room, the reading lamp will be on, the yellow one with the pleated shade that stands over the wing-back chair. I get to the archway. I was right. It is the reading lamp. Frances is there, looking at me already. I wonder how long she's been waiting for me. She had blonde ringlets then and no laugh lines.
She's sitting on Daddy's lap, sideways, facing me, rocking. He's rocking her. but it's not working. She's wide awake. He doesn't see me because he's looking into her hair. His mouth is open a little, an upside-down new moon. He's making the sound. The skin on his face looks pulled back by an undertow. His head is straining forward not to drown. His right hand hovers, barely touching the halo of yellow fuzz Frances gets from turning on her pillow, and his left hand is under and up her nightgown like a puppeteer's. He says something I can't hear, then breathes up hard through his nose, then, "My little girl," and the chewed-up word, "beautiful." Then he shoves her down between his legs and pins one hand across her chest, the other one still operating underneath. They're both facing in the same direction now, but Frances turns her face to keep our eyes together. His head snaps back, and he jams her up between his legs once, again, three times and a half, until he trembles at the ceiling. That's when the fear goes out of him, and he crumples around her and cries into her hair. Frances and I keep looking at each other until he falls asleep like that. Then she crawls out from behind his arms and walks over to me. "It doesn't hurt," she says. Now I see a piece of him behind the narrow opening in his pants. I go get the crocheted comforter from the sofa, and I pull it over him without looking again. It's rude to stare. Sizzling comes from the kitchen across the hall. I don't like that smell of kidneys cooking.
"Me neither,"
says Frances. We go back upstairs to bed, and I sing songs to her until I fall asleep. The next day, Frances sucked on dough, and Mama died in the kitchen. The piano is a mirror, but Mercedes is not staring at herself. She's staring at her father, passed out beneath the crocheted blanket.
"Mercedes? What are you doing up, Lily? Is Frances home yet?"
"No."
"Are you worried this time?"
"Yes."
"I know where she is. Ambrose told me."
Lily can't tell Mercedes how she knows where Frances goes when she doesn't come home. That would mean tattling on Frances for scaring the pee out of her that day at the old French mine when they were supposed to be at Brownie's and Guide's. It would also mean revealing that it was Frances who told Lily about Ambrose in the first place, and where he lives now, and what he does at night.
If Mercedes finds that out, she might start treating Frances as though she, too, were special to God.
Frances wouldn't like that. She might run away. Or worse, if Mercedes finds out that Ambrose is a gift from Frances, she might think Ambrose is evil. Mercedes knows Frances is bad, but loves her anyway. Because however hard it is to be the good one in the family, it is harder still to be the bad one. Lily understands that. Who in the world does Lily love more than Frances? Not even Daddy. Who in the world does she fear more than Mercedes, whose cocoa tin has filled 20 times over against Lily's 14th birthday, when they will journey to Lourdes along with the throngs of other special people who come to bathe in Our Lady's own creek and leave their specialness behind forever? Lily has promised herself, her little leg, that, 1, she will never let it be cut off, and, 2, she will never let it be obliterated by a miracle. The idea of betraying so valiant a limb, which is carried and marched beyond the call of duty, to say, "Here is your reward," to cease to be, to become instead a false twin for the good leg. Her bad leg is special because it is so strong. Lily has learned, however, that to others it is special because it is weak. No one, not even Our Lady, will get their holy waters on her little leg. I can't tell Mercedes the true history of Ambrose, thinks Lily. Mercedes loves me because I'm special to God. If she thinks I'm special to the devil, I might have to run away. I saw through the cracks in Mercedes' fingers how Daddy wound up at the bottom of the stairs.
Where?
Mercedes has no expression on her face. Lily looks up at Mercedes, and the bump appears faintly in her forehead.
Ambrose says not to worry. It's not a bad man she's with.
Lily is fairly sure that at least the latter part is true. Daddy was away at work today. Mercedes was off cleaning the sacristy of Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church, and Lily was in her room starting a diary.
Dear diary, allow me to introduce myself.
When Frances ran down from the attic and past the bedroom door, where Lily caught a glimpse of her and cried,
Frances!
But Frances clattered down the front hall stairs, catapulting over the last 5 steps, hitting the floor with a thump and a spring to the door. Lily took the stairs as fast as she dared.
Frances, what happened to you?
Stumbling and clinging to the railing halfway down.
Frances!
Cried Lily.
Frances!
She mocked back, yanking open the door and turning to grin up at Lily. The left side of her face all bloody, her guide neckerchief soaked. Tears sprang to Lily's eyes, but Frances said, as though stating the obvious,
Don't worry, Lily. It's not real blood.
And she was gone. Lily went up to the attic, but all she found there was the empty coal scuttle. She touched the lip of it, and her finger came away red. She tasted it. Salt. An iron. She washed the scuttle in the bathroom and took it back down to the cellar. Lily can't tell Mercedes that Frances beat herself up. Mercedes might think Frances is crazy. That, too, can be grounds for specialness to God.
Go get dressed, Lily.
Mercedes has never driven the car before. James always parks it in second gear, so it has stayed in second the whole way. Mercedes gripping the wheel and peering forward into the lit-up darkness.
She has a beat-up face, but the man didn't do it.
I know, Lily. Lily looks sharply across at Mercedes and tests her cautiously.
I saw how it happened.
Mercedes returns the look.
Did he see you watching? I don't think so.
Don't worry, Lily. He'll never touch her again. It's on the tip of Lily's tongue to say, it wasn't Daddy. But she doesn't. The fog has settled, and they are in the midst of a soft void. It's as though they've ceased to travel forward at all, the car just rocking gently side to side. Mercedes returns her eyes to the blind windshield.
I won't let him.
They crawl along in silence for a while. You can tell where the edge of the road is by reaching out through the passenger window till you feel the pine needles going by. Lily loses herself in this task, but gives a start when something chilly alights on her other hand.
Say a little prayer with me for Daddy, Lily.
And Mercedes closes her hand around Lily's.
Let us ask God to forgive him. Because he knows not what he does,
says Lily.
Let's say a decade of the beads. Did you bring a rosary? We don't need a rosary, Lily. We have faith.
But Mercedes needs to count something, so she counts the nubs of the wooden steering wheel, a nub for each whispered prayer, allowing them to slip beneath her fingers. One by one by one. By the time Mercedes' left hand has gone 3 times around the steering wheel, her other hand has drained the warmth from Lily's, and they both of them are cold. An increase in the pressure of their backs against the seat tells them that the road has started to ascend. The last strands of fog caress the car, releasing it back into time and space and night. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be.
Turn here.
That's not a road, Lily.
I know.
They lurch and rumble through the squeaking branches till the back of a truck appears in their lights. Mercedes feels her eyes and stomach go watery. She reads the name stenciled there.
Leo Taylor Transport.
He's not a bad man, Mercedes.
Their lights fade from the rear of the truck. They get out of the car. Mercedes has brought Daddy's old pit lantern. She lights it. It's a sin for Lily to let Mercedes think it was Daddy who beat up Francis. But he has done it in the past. Surely truth can be borrowed across time without perishing. Shelf life, so to speak. Though Lily knows the man in the mine with Francis did not hit her, she is nevertheless worried. In the movies, when a girl is interested in a man, she gets dressed up, powders her nose, and puts on a little lipstick. But what kind of man is it for whom a girl would see fit to render herself more attractive by bashing in her own face? Lily and Mercedes walk slowly, scraping their way through the woods, pinning back boughs for each other. Lily strains to spot the trail that Francis blazed in the trees that November day almost 3 years ago. She hasn't mentioned the trail to Mercedes. After all this time, you'd never notice the marks unless you knew they were there. Francis carved each one with the kitchen scissors. Scissors have not changed since ancient history. The Egyptians had scissors and eyeshadow and jewelry and pet cats just as we do. It's in a beautiful golden book that Lily got for Christmas from Daddy, Secrets of King Tut. But they didn't have the wheel.
Do you think the Egyptians had the wheel, Mercedes?
I'm sure I neither know nor greatly care.
I think they did, but it was too holy to them to draw it. Or else they wanted to keep it a secret.
Mercedes stops.
How much farther? We're halfway there.
They've just passed the tree marked with an R, the fourth of seven letters, each spaced seven trees apart.
After all, Lily continues, they worshipped the sun, and the sun is round.
Lily counts seven trees and stops again. Mercedes holds the lantern up to a gouge in the bark where Lily is peering.
What are you looking at?
Oh,
Lily reads, then turns to Mercedes.
We're almost there.
Mercedes knows only that her sister is being guided. She looks down into Lily's eyes, and Lily feels her back open up like a book on either side of her spine,
onto a dark and endless corridor full of something Mercedes craves. This is the look of reverence. Like the look of pity, it is frightening. But Lily has learned how to remain Lily while receiving such a look. She holds her eyes the way you might hold your arms when looking up at someone who is in danger of falling from a high place. Still, steady, outstretched. This discourages the person from jumping and killing you both, for perhaps they just wanted to know there was someone waiting below to catch them.
The way Lily looks when she calmly holds out her eyes in this manner is what the lookers of pity and reverence call beatific.
Are you tired, Lily?
Mercedes asks gently, allowing Lily's back to close up again.
No, we're almost there.
And they walk on, S, and finally, E.
Up there,
Lily points. Mercedes raises the lantern to the sudden incline of the hill.
You'd better wait here, Lily.
No, I better come.
They hold hands and traverse the hill. Unlike Francis, Mercedes paid attention at guides and learned how to climb a steep hill without falling, how to swim safely across a current. Mercedes knows that Francis is no stranger to men. She only wonders how Frances has avoided pregnancy for so long. But tonight is different. For Daddy to be upset, it has to be.
Different how?
Mercedes wondered, as soon as James was prone at the foot of the stairs. She has been going over that question, and she has come up with an answer. It was Lily saying that Frances was not with a bad man that tipped Mercedes off. It must be that Frances is in love, planning to elope with this man, whoever he is. But why elope? There must be some obstacle. The man must be married. What would become of Frances, on the run with a man not bound by law to look after her? How long could anyone, man or woman, put up with Frances? Who else but Mercedes knows how to love Frances? And where would Frances and her lover be by the time he'd had enough? Hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles away, maybe in another country. Frances, stranded, without money or love, would die far from home. Mercedes can't bear the thought. It burns her throat and salts her eyes. Dear Frances. My little Frances, alone, dying, and no one there to love her because no one there remembers. Mercedes bends to the hill. They're almost there. Hurry, Lily. Thank you, God. Thank you, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and all the saints for Lily, who is divinely inspired. If Lily's premonition proves correct and prevents Frances from running away, then that will be a miracle indeed. Time enough to contact the Archdiocese once Frances is safely home. The old pit lantern lights up the rim of the arch. Torn earth, a fringe of tangled grass, a limestone gash, and within, the gleaming textures of the walls. Cave paintings would never last in here. Too damp. Mercedes calls softly, "Frances," Lily whispers. "The tunnel goes around a bend, then there's a pool of deep water." "Please, God, let it be a good man." They walk in. "Frances!" Frances will hide, Mercedes thinks. So she proceeds slowly, casting the lantern from side to side, examining every nook and cranny. Lily keeps her eyes on her feet, waiting for the yelp of fear when Mercedes sees the dead miner, the dead soldier. But it doesn't come. As with so much else of what she remembers, Lily wonders, was it just a dream? Did that happen? Was that really me? The corridor begins to curve to the left. Frances has heard her name and shoves Ginger off her. He wakes, cold with misery, full of apology. "Shut up," she says. "Someone's coming." She feels around for the rock under which she hid her uniform. "Stay here, Frances. I'll go and see who it is."
"It's my sister, and Christ only knows who else."
Scuffling into her clothes. He's bewildered. The water of the pool was not as cold as this.
"Frances, I didn't mean to take advantage of you."
She laughs, hauling on her shoes. This time they both hear her name.
"Sweet Jesus."
He feels for his fly and buttons up. Her footsteps start away. Ginger flails out and catches her bicep, so fragile.
"Ow!"
She writhes, but he won't let her go.
"Where are you going?"
"Home."
"What's the matter with you, girl?"
"Get your hands off me."
"I'm sorry I touched you. If I got you in trouble, if I hurt you..."
She laughs. He lets her go. "Look," she's all business.
"Just forget about it. We both got what we wanted."
"You wanted me to help you."
"You did, thank you. If this doesn't work, then I'm probably infertile, since you obviously aren't."
At this, he seizes her again, pinning her elbows against her ribs.
What do you mean?
He is shocked by his own anger.
Relax, buddy. I don't want anything else from you. And I won't tell anyone if you don't.
But he doesn't let her go. His hot breath is on her face. He feels he could break her in two right this instant. Just like that, and it scares him. Francis knows better. If a man is going to hurt you badly, the first blow will come within 3 seconds. It's been over 10 now, and he's still just hanging on and heaving air.
Come on, Leo. You liked it. I could tell.
I saved your life.
My fuzzy arse, you did.
He falters, not wanting to take it in just yet.
What about your daddy? You can't go back. He'll kill you.
She goes all haughty and upper crust.
My father has never laid a hand on me.
He lets her go. A light appears around the bend. Francis walks toward it.
He never does see who or how many have come for her. Of everything, perhaps he is most ashamed of staying behind, cowering in reliance on her promise not to tell.
But what would happen to his family if he were killed here tonight? Disgrace and destitution.
At the thought of his family, Ginger emerges from what seems to him now to have been a narcotic haze.
There in the dripping mine, his head feels clear and whole for the first time, and he doesn't know how long.
Since New York.
His heart is heavy, leaking and frayed, but it is his own. He feels acutely present in every particle of his body, and his body is more worn than it was last time he looked, like the body of a loved one, long thought dead, who returns looking older but so much more like himself than anything recorded in memory or photographs. He is filled with the joy and sorrow of the reunion with himself. Forgiveness. The sun is about to show. The rifle jiggles on Adelaide's knees, and she can't help a yawn. Teresa exchanges a look with Wilfred Beale.
Wilf says, "There's a hunting cabin down this road I used to use. If it's still there, it's a likely spot."
"Never mind, Wilf," says Adelaide. "Let's go home. He's probably there waiting on me by now."
Teresa is relieved. They've been driving Addie around all night, wearing her out with dirt roads. They drove halfway to Meat Cove, and it's finally worked. Teresa wasn't worried that their search would turn up anything. She just wanted to keep Adelaide away from the Piper house with that rifle. She's got a short wick, her sister-in-law. God love her. No good telling her that Ginger wouldn't touch that ghost of a girl with a 10-foot pole. Adelaide is right. When they pull up in front of her house, it's light enough to see through the windows of the locked double doors that Ginger's truck is safely inside the garage. When Frances greeted Lily and Mercedes in the mine, she just said, "Did you bring the car?" Mercedes was so relieved, she didn't at first notice Lily straying around the bend where Frances had appeared.
"Lily, we're going home now."
"What about the man?"
"He has his own vehicle," answered Mercedes.
She did not wish to see what lay around the bend. It was enough for her that Francis was content to leave it behind. Once home, Francis refuses to take a bath.
"I had one last night."
When Mercedes tries her strong-arm matron thing, Francis resists like a cat, clinging hands and feet to the sides of the tub till Mercedes gives up. Then Francis washes her hands, her face, and feet while Mercedes stands waiting with a fresh towel.
"Are you in love with him?"
Francis just snorts.
"Do you plan to see him again?"
What, are you jealous, Mercedes?
I don't want you to get hurt.
Maybe you're a lezzy, Mercedes. Did you ever think of that? Have you tried it? Want to? We could.
Francis laughs without finding it funny. Nothing seems that funny anymore. She has a delicious, tired feeling creeping up.
Are you hungry?
Asks Mercedes.
Yes.
I'll make us some cinnamon toast.
And she turns to leave.
Mercedes.
Mercedes pauses in the bathroom door but does not turn. Francis continues.
I'm going to be good from now on. I'm going to have a healthy baby.
Mercedes takes a breath and lowers her head.
Mercedes?
Yes.
Can we have cocoa, too?
Of course.
Come in for a cuppa.
Wilf and Teresa politely decline. Adelaide enters her house, dog tired. Ginger has made tea and tea biscuits, and he is freshly bathed and changed. He says to his wife,
Addie, I'm going to tell you everything, and then you can tell me if you want me to leave.
Give me a cup of tea first, Leo.
She sinks onto a kitchen chair with a physical relief that would make sense if she had spent the night walking instead of driving.
By the end of his story, Adelaide's freckles are more prominent than before.
But that could be because she's tired. He breaks the silence that follows with,
You want me to go?
No.
I can only stay if you can forgive me. Otherwise, there's no point.
She looks at him across the tea. It's as though a mist had cleared from his face. He's back. She gets a retroactive shiver at the thought of how he's been lost and wandering in a wilderness not his own.
Can you forgive yourself?
She asks.
I think I have. Because, you see, she's gone right out of me.
I believe you.
But do you forgive me?
That's what I said.
You said,
I forgive you.
She never cries, so when she does, the tears are hot pepper.
I'm sorry,
he says. She wraps him up with her long muscles, graceful bone blades, reddish halo.
Don't ever leave me.
I never, never will.
I love you.
I love you.
She runs a hand over his half inch of soft, rough hair, squeezes his shoulders, loses her narrowness in the fold of his belly, and feels her back supported by his arms, which are as strong as they look. They hold each other and think about all their children and feel in themselves no limit to what they can make together, what they can give to each other. She slips her hands onto his hips. Upstairs, the baby awakens. Morning. A new and glorious morn. Across town, Camille makes her first pot of tea as a widow. The word isn't in yet about her son, but she knows about the loss of her husband. A very young Mountie banged on the door just before midnight. She hadn't been going to open up for him, thinking it was a raid. Then she figured, what's the difference? It's not as though her husband has kept her in the style to which a successful ginslinger's wife might reasonably expect to become accustomed. So she opened up, and the Mountie said with a long face,
I'm sorry, missus, but I have some bad news for you.
Then he came out with the anticlimax of a lifetime. The first of Camille's sons to arrive home had difficulty opening the front door against the weight of her steamer trunk.
Ma, what's going on?
She lumbered down the stairs with a hat box in one hand and a suitcase containing her wedding gown in the other.
Your father's dead. I'm going home. Now Camille fixes a cup of tea the way Pa likes it, and carries it up the stairs to his bedroom. It's dawn. He doesn't know she's here. She's going to surprise him. Mercedes sits on the piano bench and watches James until his eyes snap open at dawn. It's a habit he got in the war. She takes a reading on his position. What do you remember from last night? James blinks, crystal blue and innocent. Wake up, she says. The last thing Mercedes wants right now is to see him as a tousled little boy. He jerks to a sitting position, where he finds his headache waiting for him. It tightens over his scalp, and he ages the 40 years back to reality.
What happened? He asks.
You got drunk and fell. He winces and looks at the floor. Then he remembers.
Where's Francis?
Francis is sleeping. Sit down. He's fully awake now and has registered Mercedes' unaccustomed tone. He looks at her and sits back down slowly.
What did I do?
You tried to touch Lily.
His hands fly up to keep his shattered face from spilling onto the carpet. A moan oozes out between his fingers.
Mercedes feels a twinge of compunction, then thrusts the point of her lie under and up. I had to drag you off her. He doubles over, caught in the ribs. His moan turns to a squeak. Mercedes gives quarter. She didn't wake up.
His head starts shaking no behind his hands. He leaves the sofa without straightening up. To do so might be to lose his guts, and he staggers out of the room, out of the house like that. Mercedes hears the car engine start.
If her father chooses to drive himself over a cliff, so be it. And if Mercedes burns an extra millennium in purgatory as a result, that's simply the cost of doing business with God. The bottom line is that she has rescued Francis. Finally. Mercedes is neither a saint nor a sinner. She is somewhere in between. She is why purgatory was invented. Over a late and unusually hearty breakfast, Francis reads about the accident in the Cape Breton Post. Jamil, well, that doesn't matter much either way. Her days as a booze queen being over, but Boutros? That is a relief. The way he looked at her. Not like the other fellows. Brooding, as if he wanted something she didn't have for sale. What that could be, she could only imagine as rape.
Are you sure you want more porridge, Francis?
Look, Lily, that's our cousin and our uncle by marriage. Lily refills Francis's bowl and reads the headline.
Hero's Death for Whitney Pierman.
The story reports that the brand-new 1932 eight-cylinder Kissel swerved to avoid a carload of Congregation of Notre Dame nuns on their way back to Holy Angels from an evening spent at a massed choir practice.
Mercedes was there.
So what, Lily?
Well, she said Sister St. Monica offered her a drive home, but she said she wanted to walk. But if she'd taken the drive, then the sisters wouldn't have passed the car with our cousin and uncle in it, and they wouldn't have crashed.
Yeah, Lily. And if a zillion invertebrates hadn't died around here a trillion stupid years ago, we wouldn't have a gravel driveway. Lily reads on.
It says the Mounties got to the car and knew someone else was driving because Mr. Jamil was lodged in the passenger side of the vehicle. Boutros Jamil was found on the rail tracks. After having crashed to avoid the nuns, he walked 2 miles toward New Waterford in the throes of death, presumably in order to fetch a doctor for his father.
Francis is thoroughly creeped. Imagine that enormous living dead man slouching toward New Waterford, set to heave himself on her with his dying breath. Just how hard was it for him to be killed is a measure of what she would have been in for if he had ever got his massive mitts on her. The young Mountie guides his cruiser over a well-worn dirt track through the woods, following a crudely drawn map. Jamil was a half-decent businessman. He kept a strict account of all his transactions in a small leather-bound notebook that the Mountie found tucked in his breast pocket at the crash site. Jamil had been careful not to use any real names, however. His code name for James, the Onclees Bastard. The penciled map leading to the distillery of the Onclees Bastard was an incautious but temporary measure. He drew it according to James's instructions over the phone when Taylor quit. X marks the spot. But when the young Mountie pulls up this morning, expecting either to nab his man or to lie in wait, all that's left of X is a charred patch of earth and some smoking planks. So much for corpus delicti. The Mountie turns round and heads back to Sydney. He doesn't see the tan Buick sedan parked in a gully nearby.
Is she going to holla rape?
No. The Cape Breton Post is on Teresa's kitchen table. She and Adelaide have agreed that Ginger picked as good a time as any to quit Jamil's. Hector is in his usual place, rocking. Teresa pours Adelaide more tea.
What makes you so sure?
Teresa asks. 'Cause she got what she wanted, so she said.
What's that?
A baby. Teresa is struck dizzy but doesn't let on. She sits down carefully and commences to stir and stir her tea, asking,
"Do you believe that?"
"If she timed it right, sure. You can tell if it takes, you know. I always could, right from the first one." Adelaide feels bad suddenly, because here she is talking to Teresa about how a woman knows when she's pregnant, while Teresa herself is bound never to be so, though it's what she wanted most. Adelaide has always wondered how a head injury could injure a man's sexual power. That steel bar never fell on Hector's privates. His seed must be good as ever, and he's not downright paralyzed, just all over reduced. If it had been Adelaide, she'd have seen if he still worked. Then she would have got a baby from him. Hector loves children. They could have managed. She and Ginger would have helped look after it. But Adelaide knows Teresa is different, altogether finer. She's like royalty, the real kind. Not snobbish, just innately fine. You can't picture Teresa straddling a broken-down man for his seed. So if Hector still does work in that way, Adelaide's certain Teresa hasn't tested him out. Teresa's in her 40s. Soon she'll be too old, if she isn't already.
Addie, what if it's true?
Don't worry, Therese. I've got something in mind. Addie, Therese, don't ask, 'cause I'm not telling anyone beforehand. I don't want anyone changing my mind this time or driving me all over Hell's Half Acre. Adelaide gives Hector a pat on the head and goes home to get supper. Thanks for the tea, girl. Teresa sees her to the door and returns to the kitchen, where Hector is staring at the top cupboard with a worried look in his eye.
"Don't worry, honey," she tells Hector. "It's still there."
But she goes to the back room to fetch the stepladder, intending to take a look just to be sure. Teresa is not one to clamber on kitchen.